Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Cale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujeet Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 53, being recorded on the 19th of November, 2014, with special guest Jeff Little. My name is Sujeet Mello. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft in the app dev space based out of New Jersey. And on Skype with me, I have my esteemed colleague, Cale, and our special guest. Guys, please introduce yourselves.
Hi, this is Cale. I'm also in the New York region, but I work for the Azure PaaS COE, the Platform as a Service COE, and I'm a consultant with Microsoft as well.
And I'm Jeff Little. I'm a principal consultant also in the New Jersey area, and I work in both SharePoint and Business Intelligence.
So we really appreciate Jeff taking the time to join us today. He's as you mentioned, he does work in the BI space. He's one of our leading experts in that area, and he's also done some work using BI in Azure, which is how I got interested in talking to him and asked him to come on this show to share some of the experiences. I realized we hadn't really talked much about BI on Azure, and I figured, you know, I'm sure our listeners are interested in something like that. It's definitely one of the good use cases to put up on Azure, just because of the nature of BI being very, you know, something you do on a specific times of the month, year, or whatever, which makes sense in Azure. But before we get started, I would like to do a couple of, actually one big housekeeping item. I guess, you know, yesterday, I think all our listeners probably know this, and I just wanted to mention it, that we did have a very big outage on Azure. And it affected the Azure storage subsystem, as was revealed today by Jason Zander in a blog post. I'll put the link in the show notes. He gave some information about why this problem happened, and it was basically affected the storage system, and the storage is the underpinning of almost everything in Azure. And at least, you know, from my own personal experience yesterday, I noticed some of my websites were unavailable. That's how I first got to know it, and I was doing some development work with the storage tables, and they were giving errors. Guys, did you guys have any experiences yesterday on Azure? What did you notice?
Yeah, mine was less work-related. I was getting ready to play Halo, and when I logged onto my Xbox, I couldn't find my profile for some reason, and that's because, you know, my game save and my profile are stored in the cloud, which is Azure. So,
And I was getting storage errors when I tried to log in to play Titanfall.
Excellent. Just see how that affects everybody, whether you're in business or, you know, pleasure. It was, you know, as light as we're making of it here, it was an extremely serious problem. There's no doubt about that, and it affected a lot of people, a lot of customers. Microsoft's obviously doing all their due diligence to figure out, you know, how to prevent that from happening again. And as a matter of fact, some of our astute listeners might notice that our normal colleague, Evan Basilek, is not with us today. He's not on the show today. And you can guess why. You know, Evan works in the support, Azure support division. And guess what he's doing right now? He's taking calls from customers who are having problems with their Azure system because of the outage yesterday. I believe he's been, you know, pretty much around the clock on support issues and things like that, trying to help customers and get them back up and running. So, you know, he's had a rough time, and hopefully we'll have him back for the next episode. Anyways, we'll put a link to that blog post from Jason Zander in the show notes, so people can get some more information about what happened there. But it was related to an upgrade they were making with the storage system. Apparently, they had tested it over the past few weeks by using this term called flighting, which we actually talked about in the last podcast. Kale was nice enough to tell us what flighting was, which is it. Kale, go ahead and explain again what that is.
Yeah, I mean, the flighting is the term that we use internally, and it's external now, right? It's on public blog posts and those kind of things for when we're doing testing and rolling this out to, you know, some people to begin with. So typically in the past, people have heard things like betas and even like alpha testing a little bit, and that's where that term's coming from. So when you hear something is being flighted, means it's being, you know, tested in real environment, like out with some users.
Right. And typically what they do is they take a small percentage of the whole user base, and that percentage, it's kind of randomly done sometimes, and that percentage of the user base will be given the new code, you know, will be set up to use the new code, so they can just monitor that small user base, make sure that they are running better, if not, you know, the same as before. And if that is the case, then they start making it available to everybody else. And apparently, that's what they had done. The test went very well over the past few months, and they decided to roll it out. And when they rolled it out, unfortunately, there was a problem.
So I don't want to tie up too much time, but that's also referred to in other spaces as canary testing. Mm. And so I know all the big players are doing this. I mean, most publicly, Google, Amazon, those kind of people, when they make changes to those big sites, they typically roll it out to, like you said, Saji, to random, like 5% of the user base or something of that nature. But one of the big downsides, if you read anything about canary testing, it's funny because I've just been reading a lot more about this topic, is one of the big downfalls is you can't guarantee that you will cover every use case, right? So, you put it out there and you put it for a small percentage of users, but there's no guarantee that you're going to cover everything.
Right.
Obviously you can put, you know, telemetry and things in there to see if it's what you're exercising on your service or whatever your application. But, that's what I've been reading. And it was funny because that was like one of the big things was, yeah, it's great, except for, you know, there's not 100% guarantee and that it would cover everything.
Good point. Yeah. That's the nature of random distribution is you just don't know what you're going to get.
Yep.
But, okay, so just wanted to mention that, and hopefully this will never happen again. I'm sure the guys will take care of that. All right, then, moving on to our special guest, Jeff Little. Jeff, can you just give us a little bit of background as to, you know, what you do in the BI space, how you got into that area, and then slowly ease yourself into what you're doing with Azure?
Sure. I got into business intelligence about 8 years ago. I used to be an app dev consultant, and I was looking for something new, and I kind of like databases, but it turns out I really don't like administering databases or all the infrastructure.
Nobody likes administrating databases. Come on.
Actually, some people do. and I found though that I really liked business intelligence because in many ways, every time you went to do it, you were really building a solution. It was development, but it was just a different type of development, and you were still building solutions that people could use. So I really liked it. So I got into business intelligence, and one of my first business intelligence projects, we were using an early version of Performance Point. I think it was still beta for SharePoint 2007. So it was kind of my introduction to SharePoint. And I realized with my app dev background that I was like, well, SharePoint's really not that hard. It's just a really big, complicated ASP.NET application. So I started to get involved into SharePoint as well right around the same time. And then right around that time, I started a new engagement where I've kind of merged the two. I'd give my customer advice on SharePoint, but I end up building a lot of data warehouses to give them the information they need to run their environment. So on any given day, sometimes I'm doing SharePoint architecture, and other days I'm writing data warehouses to give them the information that they need.
So that's kind of good because the two go kind of hand in hand, right? They are related in some way.
Well, I mean, if you look at the business intelligence stack by Microsoft, the vast majority of it is designed to run on top of SharePoint. The one exception is you can run reporting services in standalone mode.
Right.
But pretty much everything else is going to run on top of SharePoint. And reporting services runs on top of SharePoint as well and gets some nice capabilities if you do so. So you really can't escape SharePoint if you run if you're going to do business intelligence.
Got it.
So we about a year and a half ago, I'm involved with a database and BI community at Microsoft, and we wanted to look into, what could we do in the cloud with business intelligence? And they had just come out with Azure VMs at the time, and before that point, we really looked at it and said there really wasn't much we could do. The platform as a service really didn't apply to us. SQL Azure, relational database, but it doesn't really help you with data modeling where you need an analytical model.
Hmm.
Azure Reporting Services really wasn't what anyone thought it was when they heard the word reporting services. It was really just a bunch of client controls that you could embed in an application. But it missed all the necessary reporting features.
Azure Reporting Services? Sorry?
I never heard of that. Yeah, it was a short-lived. and a large part was because when people heard the word reporting services, they were thinking like a real reporting tool that could do things like send out subscriptions and notifications,
right,
which is, some of the hot features in the product. And all it really was a bunch of client-side ASP.NET and WinForms controls that you could stick in an application.
And what do those controls do? What do they show you?
They were just like, they looked like reporting services reports.
I see.
Okay. And I think a lot of it was simply the expectations,
mm-hmm,
based on the name were not what people were expecting, and they quietly turned off that feature a while ago.
Okay.
But when the Azure VMs came up, it was kind of like, wow, maybe we can begin to do BI in the cloud, because it was kind of before that point, it wasn't something we could consider. So I began to look into, what could we do on these Azure VMs? We knew we could stand up SharePoint, which was great. And we could stand up the BI stuff, but what could you do with it? And so pretty quickly, I hit a limitation, which began to narrow the scope of where I could go. And that limitation was, at the time, the largest VM available had a whopping 14 gigabytes of RAM. Which is today the extra large VM.
Okay.
And realize that for most business intelligence solutions, the way you scale is you scale up. You just keep putting it on, it's usually on one server, and you just start using bigger and bigger servers. So it's not uncommon to hear about data warehouses running on a server with, say, a terabyte of RAM.
Really?
Yeah, because you can't really split the data easily across multiple databases. So if you're sitting on top of, potentially terabytes worth of data.
Yeah, but why does it need so much memory, though? I understand
because the calculations that are being done ends up loading vast amount of data into the memory. Because, when you're looking at some of these queries, they are looking at trends across potentially years worth of data, and then some of the calculations can get very involved because you can walk up and down hierarchies of data. So you might have to sit there and say, well, I have to find all the quarterly sales over the last 10 years and organize them by user, and then organize that by whoever the regional director is or whatever, and spit out a report at the end of this.
Got it.
And all that tends to consume memory. Now, you can certainly do, those are the really big ones that sit on like a terabyte of RAM. You can certainly do smaller ones, but 14 is was on the small side. And we're kind of excited in the BI space about the new G-class Azure VMs, because I think the largest one is going to support half a terabyte of RAM. So can it handle the largest data warehouses out there? Probably not, but could it handle, you know, 75% of what's out there? Probably.
Okay.
So I looked at it at that point. You know, I'm looking at 14 gigs of RAM, and I'm saying, what scenario could I make effective?
In 14 gigs of RAM.
In 14 gigs of RAM. You know, and it really was, I could have a whole bunch of boxes with 14 gigs of RAM, but that was my max. So what's the BI scenario that lets me scale out instead of scaling up? And the one that jumped out at me was self-service BI, namely around Power Pivot, which was, you know, works very well with SharePoint. Are either of you aware of what Power Pivot is or how it works?
I have used it a little bit. I don't know about Kale.
Yeah, is that, Jeff, is that also the one that plugs into Excel? Is that, or is that a different tool?
It does. Yeah, it plugs into Excel. What Power Pivot is a type of analytical database that's designed for end users to be able to build analytical models. Before Power Pivot, if you wanted to build an analytical database, you really had to bring in a pro. And, you know, it was just not easy to do. You really had to know what you're doing. But with Power Pivot, if you knew how to use Excel, you could build an analytical model. It doesn't let you do everything that the traditional multidimensional model could. But on the other hand, you didn't have to be an expert to use it either. And Kel's right. Usually you always build these models out in Excel, and then you can publish the Power Pivot workbook, which is embedded in an Excel workbook, to SharePoint. And then once it's in SharePoint, you can view the Excel sheets in the browser, and you can also point other tools like reporting services to the Power Pivot workbook as a data source. So it's kind of like building a little mini analytical data source. But what was nice about Power Pivot was that the maximum size of a Power Pivot workbook is 2 gigs. And in reality, it's a lot more like 250 megabytes. They become very unwieldy after about 250 megabytes, mostly because you're having to pass around all this data back and forth as you want to use it.
So, Jeff, what exactly is in the Power Pivot file or data source? I mean, is it just the parameters in the schema, or is it the actual data?
Oh, it's the actual data. When you set up a workbook, you define multiple tables, and each table is a query to some data source. It could be a SQL Server. It could be an OData web source. I've used it against reporting services reports. You could even pull data directly from a page in the Excel workbook. And you can tie relationships between the tables. So you can say, well, you know, items in table A are related to table B, and the model will understand that. And if you were to crack open one of these Excel workbooks with a Power Pivot model, what you'd find is that there is a file in there, which is actually a SQL Server Analysis Services backup file. And that contains all of the information around, the analytical database. So it's basically a miniature analytical database embedded inside an Excel workbook.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, when I looked at it, I said, you know, since the largest one I can have is 2 gigs, I can fit that into a 14, an environment with 14 gigs of RAM. And if I start to go over a limit, I can just add more servers. So it was like, here is my option to scale out. This is the scenario we could handle, self-service business intelligence, which is really what Power Pivot was geared for. And as a side note, a little while later, Power BI came out for use with Office 365. And the model that Power BI uses is they go after self-service BI, and they've got a whole bunch of Power Pivot workbooks because that you can scale out.
Okay.
So they identified the same scenario I did.
So Jeff, just for my edification, what is the difference between Power BI and Power Pivot?
Power Pivot lets you create an analytical database. Power BI is a service that is provided, I want to say it's part of Office 365, but it's a It's a service that's associated with Office 365 that's designed for self-service BI, and it includes the ability to not only create and publish Power Pivot workbooks. It also lets you publish Power View reports, which are these analytical dashboards. It's got some semantic search capabilities, so you can type in something like I want to see my sales over the last year as a bar chart, and it'll generate a chart for you. It's very much just a self-service BI tool in the cloud. And Power Pivot is the analytical database that it uses for you to build all of your models.
Got it. Thanks.
So, Jeff, one of the things that comes to mind for me, like if I'm hearing about or thinking about data warehouses, because I don't do a lot of that day-to-day, mm-hmm. but I've been around those projects in the past, and typically there's large amounts of data. You mentioned, the memory requirements to do the crunching, but even around the data, it's typically a massive amount of data. And so have you run into any challenges there, especially when you're talking about the cloud? Because I can imagine trying to upload terabytes of data to Azure is not a happy thing.
Well, and that was, I guess, one of the beauties of dealing with when we went with Power Pivot was it immediately narrowed us into a smaller range of items because – there just was no space to store that much information in a Power Pivot workbook. If you go to a route with that much data, you need to start going to an analysis services tabular or multidimensional database. And in that scenario, you do need bigger servers. And really for those scenarios, they're only going to become available at the end of this year when the G-class VMs come online.
So is this something you still see then in your work, with customers now? Do you see a lot of people that are trending of installing, analysis services package on a VM as opposed to using Power Pivot and some of these cloud-based analytics?
Well, certainly some will consider doing it on a VM. One of the advantages of using analysis services tabular is that if you have a Power Pivot workbook, which is generally created by a business user, so it's not managed by IT. But if that workbook becomes important, if it either becomes too big or it becomes too important to just, let some business user manage it, you can take a Power Pivot workbook and you can restore it into a analysis services tabular database. And once you do that, it instantly has the ability to scale up to vast sizes and can be managed by.
Oh wow! I didn't know you could get. That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't know you could go between like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a one way. It's kind of a one way trip. So everything that Power Pivot does, tabular mode can do, but it doesn't hold the other way around.
Yep.
So tabular's got the some of the features you need to scale. So it provides you the ability to now partition data so that you no longer have to process all the data at once. It starts to add in things like row-level security. In Power Pivot, you either have access to see everything in the workbook or you don't. And with Tabular, you can now say, well, I have the access to everything, but you have access to a subset of the data. Now, that ability to pass who you are to the backend database presents a whole host of authentication challenges, which we effectively dodged as long as we were living with Power Pivot. We'll have to begin to address those as we start bringing tabular databases or multidimensional databases, make them available in Azure VMs.
So to me, it sounds like a great use case for if somebody – typically in the past when I've seen people try to get involved in data warehousing, if they weren't already in that kind of mix and the analysis services along with that, it was a huge project, right? It took a lot of planning and there was huge hardware, like you said, and there was all these things. And it sounds to me like this would be a great case for, hey, I got this idea. Like I'm thinking about how I want to look at this data. Let me try it on this. And then if that works, we can kind of scale it up then to.
Oh, yeah. And what's nice is because Tabular and Power Pivot are so similar is that I've had cases where I knew I'd be working with a tabular database. And I had to come up with a model, and I wanted to test some things out. So I would just create a PowerPivot workbook real fast because I didn't have to set up any hardware. It's fire up Excel and create some tables. And what's nice is because you can import data from an Excel worksheet. Well, I create a couple Excel worksheets. I put it in some mock data, and then I build a model based on that, and I can see how well the model works. And if the model doesn't work, then it's easy to tweak because I haven't really made that much of an investment. It's really just an Excel file that I'm working with.
Sounds great. Excellent. So you were saying you were going down this path about using it for self-service BI, but more like self-service Power Pivot, or were you going down with that?
We call it self-service BI because Power Pivot becomes the data source.
Right.
But then there's a whole host of data of tools that you can use to talk to that data source. So you can use Excel services to view the data in Power Pivot.
So you install all this on the VM now? Is that what you're...
Yep. We typically what you'll do is we'll put the SharePoint, you'll have SharePoint front ends.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can also run most of the BI services. Sometimes we'll see a separation where we'll have the front ends do the basic load, and then there'll be an app server which will run the BI pieces. And the decision around that is usually based on what else the farm is used for. If the SharePoint farm is strictly a BI farm, you can put everything in a single layer because you'll get a better use of resources.
Right.
But if that farm is going to support something else, like a collaboration workload, then you put the BI services in a separate tier so that if the BI services get overwhelmed, they don't take out your entire farm.
True.
So you've got these other BI services that we set up, things like reporting services. So, with reporting services, you can now pull data directly out of one of these Power Pivot workbooks. You can use Power View to create a dynamic dashboard. You could use Performance Point as well. So you've got a bunch of tools that you can pull from to display this data from Power Pivot.
Okay. So what were some of the challenges that you had when setting this up, or was there anything in particular that stood out as something you had to overcome?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to install in a SharePoint farm. So some of it was just figuring out, what are the steps? And the steps between setting a Power Pivot on a SharePoint 2010 environment versus 2013 is night and day. It's a completely different set of steps. So what we found worked best was stand up SharePoint 2013 by itself. Just get it running and validated. Then typically we start bringing up the BI services one at a time. And as each one comes up, we test it and validate it. So a lot of times we'll just start with reporting services. We make sure that gets up and running. And then usually we'll bring up Power Pivot. Because once Power Pivot's up, then you can test Power View pretty easily.
Now, just how exactly do you test this? Do you actually put a small workbook out there and just make sure it's working?
There's a demo out there called it's called the Hello World Picnic. And it's, if you just search for Hello World Picnic in Power Pivot, you'll find it pretty fast. It's a tiny little workbook.
Okay.
And it also comes with a Power View report, which is nice. So you just take the Power Pivot workbook, you upload it, and then you can view it in Excel services, and you can make sure that the slicers and things work. A slicer are these buttons that let you pick different items in the report. So if you change the slicers and the data changes, then you know you're in good shape. And then you can take the Power View workbook that comes with it, and you can put that in place in SharePoint, point it at the Power Pivot workbook, and when you go in there, you should be able to click on all these different things, and the values should change. And that's kind of your validation.
Cool.
That it works. So there was some of sorting out, how all these pieces work, and what did you have to install on each machine? And the thing you have to keep in mind with Power Pivot is that the actual work of Power Pivot is done on these things called SSAS for SharePoint Service, which is SQL Server Analysis Services for SharePoint. So you've got these servers. You don't even have to install any SharePoint bits on them, but you have to install this specialized version of analysis services that's designed to work with SharePoint. And then over the SharePoint side, you've got to run some configuration tools to set up all the SharePoint bits that know how to talk to these servers. And then you have to configure Excel services to understand, you know, what Power Pivot servers are out there so it can make use of multiple servers.
Hey, yeah, and Jeff, one thing just for our listeners, does this solution, the stuff that you're describing here, does this work with SQL Server 2012 and 14? Is there any differences?
I have not seen major differences between SQL 2012 and 2014, at least from like an architecture perspective. I will say this, though. If you are using SharePoint 2013, it is SQL Server 2012 SP1. SP0, but the RTM version is only designed to work with SharePoint 2010. If you're in 2013, you must have SP1. And if you want to use PowerView with a multidimensional database, I think it's CU4 that you need after that.
So definitely 2008 R2s, no dice.
No, not for Power Pivot, and reporting services is a nightmare to set up in 2008 R2 and earlier. And it's because if you're in a multi-server environment, if you set up two servers, you must also set up Kerberos delegation to make it all work. And that's challenging. You know, just to be able to run a report with 20 and it's up to 30% slower than what you get in 2012. In 2012, reporting services becomes a SharePoint service application. It becomes natively embedded as part of SharePoint. And so all these performance issues go away. The setup is a lot easier.
Nice.
Now, just to be clear, so SQL Server is also running on the same box, right? This is a self-contained box at this point?
For a development box, I put them all on one machine.
Okay.
But if I was going to do production, what I'd have is I'd have a database tier where I'd realistically have I'd have a database cluster, though it's not really clustered. It'd really be two databases connected via availability groups. So you'd have a primary and a secondary.
Mm.
Then I'd have, at another tier, I would have the SQL Server analysis for Power Pivot servers. And as long as those are up, you have redundancy. If one goes down, SharePoint will just go use the other one. And then you'd have your web front ends slash app servers, depending upon what your configuration is. Mm-hmm. And in each one of these tiers, you'd have at least two servers. So you can very quickly end up, for even a small installation, you're looking at
six VMs.
And in reality, it's more like 9 or 11 because your distributed cache server you should have a separate layer for distributed cache, and you should really have a separate layer for any of the backend processing you need to do along with your workflow pieces. Now, depending upon your load, you might be able to collapse some of those levels together. But as you get bigger, you have to start yanking those out. But the number of servers can go up pretty quickly.
So you're talking of SharePoint workflows, right? The approval workflows and whatnot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing about that tier is wherever tier you put the workflows is if you want high availability of your workflows, you need at least three servers in tier. So I think, you know, when you start looking into this, it's like, well, but you've got two for the distributed cache, two web front ends, two app servers, two Power Pivot servers, two more database servers, and like pretty quickly you're up to like 11 servers or something. 11 VMs.
And is there any chance of using SQL Azure for the database component?
Nope.
That is
an unsupported scenario for SharePoint.
For SharePoint, I see.
And what you have to realize is that, you know, first of all, content by default is stored inside of SharePoint. It isn't stored inside of SQL for SharePoint. And there is a latency limitation that when you pull that when a web front end requests data from SharePoint, it must start coming back from the database within, it's like 1 millisecond or 5 milliseconds. So that database has to be nearby. In fact, the requirement generally is that all the servers in a farm must be on the same LAN. They must be fairly close together. So there's, you know, every once in a while, you hear someone will try to want to do something. We'll put half the servers in one data center and half the servers in another data center to build what's called a stretch farm. And that is generally unsupported. I think there are a few scenarios that you can get done, but you'll find what it is the two data centers are fairly close together and they're connected by like dark fiber. So the latency is really low. But the problem is if you're wherever you're at, there's a good chance that the SQL Azure databases are just too far away. And I don't believe they may not support all the features, but they specifically state that as of this point, SQL Azure databases are not supported.
Okay.
Now, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, because, you know, that's the biggest sort of central point of failure, and you want to make sure that's, you know, rock solid.
Yeah, and realize that, you know, SharePoint creates a lot of databases. I mean, just to bring up, you know, a basic form like we talked about, it's probably going to create like 15 databases by the time it gets done. Because every service application gets its own database. Your configuration database gets its own thing. You know, if you set up search, it gets its own database. I mean, so very quickly, you end up with a lot of databases.
Now, you know, I think a couple of episodes ago, we talked about these new VMs, which have the SSD drives in them. What is that? Is that the A series, Kale? Or was that
the D
series?
I know Jeff was talking about the further ones, the G's.
But the G's, So the G's also have SSD. Is that it? I lost track.
The largest of the G's had up to 50,000 IOPS available.
Oh, nice. So I guess you could really get a lot of benefit by using one of those, I suppose, because I believe SQL does take good advantage of the new version of SQL Server, right? That's what they told us. Can use an SSD drive for temp storage and things like that. And you get a lot of performance on it. I believe that's what Evan mentioned on that particular episode. But
yeah,
anyways.
And well, I was more excited about the half terabyte of RAM you could get because
sure, that always helps.
Right, and if you're dealing with the tabular database or Power Pivot, those work by loading the entire model into memory. Mm-hmm. So that lets you have a fairly large model that can be loaded in an environment. And once those databases are loaded in memory, they're very fast.
Okay, great. So is that all the steps then you just described? Was there anything in addition to what you just described that you had to do to get it up and running once you set that up?
No, that pretty much was it. Although you do have to model the security of the farm. So usually, you know, when you do a model for a SharePoint farm, usually you're looking at about 6 different service accounts that are set up in different ways. So you do have to pay attention to that. Don't just set everything up as a super user account.
Okay.
So it's like 6 to 8 or 6 to 9, depending upon what you're doing, because some accounts require more than others. And then the other thing you want to keep in mind is if you are, you know, starting to look at something like a G series where you can talk to these larger databases, you do have to keep in mind if you're going to need to pass end user credentials to the backend databases. So in that scenario we talked about where, you know, you and I could run a report and go to a dashboard and you would see one set of data and I would see another. And for that to happen, your credentials have to pass all the way back to that analysis services database. And as app dev guys, you guys are probably familiar with the double hop problem where right. Well, if you hit that immediately in the SharePoint scenario.
This is the impersonation problem, right?
Right. Yes, because SharePoint won't pass your credentials to the back-end data source. So you have to set up Kerberos delegation or effective username you can use in some scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
But Kerberos is kind of the one that more commonly crops up. So you've got to set that up, and that's not simple in SharePoint because you oftentimes have multiple service accounts set up, and there's certain services that you have to provide with very high level of rights. Mostly there's a claims to Windows token service, which is responsible for converting a SharePoint claim into a Windows token. And it's got to get converted to Windows token because analysis services right now only understands, Windows authentication mechanisms. So it's got to get turned from a claim into a Windows token.
So Jeff, I had one other question. So if we, in like a hybrid type scenario, so if we, you mentioned about, you know, the new G series coming and potentially, you know, running some of this stuff up there. But if we were using, for instance, if we were using SharePoint Online, like O365, and using like the Power BI, so we, or even just publishing some Power Pivot stuff, if we were using that component, but we wanted to use some data that resided on an on-premise database, is that possible through that?
Well, usually what you would do in that scenario is if you had data. I guess there's two scenarios. One is if the raw data is sitting like in a relational database, or are we talking to analysis services?
Yep. Talking about relational. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're relational, what you typically would do is you'd use a fixed connection, set of credentials to pull all the data into your analytical model, and then in the analytical model you would put the rules in. So it typically becomes more important is that communication to the analytical model, and how is that set up? Is it set up with the rules?
So we could set up an ETL job or something like that periodically to pull it out.
Yeah, you could set up like an ETL job that would push data from on-premise, you know, into the cloud, and then you would, what's called, process the data into an analytical database. And then it really becomes, you know, how's that analytical database set up to work with the authentication mechanisms? You know, the problem you run into, though, because it requires Windows authentication, is that if you run into a scenario where you need to do this, you're kind of forced to do everything as Windows authentication. And you know, as we go to the cloud, we look more and more at claims and other authentication. But how do you convert that back to a Windows token with analysis services? And that's one of the big problems we run into that we hope will be fixed at some point.
Okay. Nice. Okay. Thanks.
And, Jeff, just to – I know we've already been on the – on this call for a while, but I just wanted to ask you a couple more questions. If the number of users increases, because you mentioned this was self-service BI, right? And let's say people are getting a lot of users and you have to generate more, you know, you have to handle more of these Power Pivot models, which tier do you see expanding in that case? Like where would you start throwing boxes or VMs?
Well, I guess it would depend on where that load was. But if the load was on the SSAS for SharePoint tier, then I would just add another one of those servers.
Okay.
And that would be one place I would suspect to see it if I was seeing enough extra workbooks added. But it's also possible that it could be the greater load could be on your front-end tier, in which case that's where you would, you know, you'd add a server. Usually, you know, you kind of just monitor each tier, and if that, you know, if one tier begins to get overloaded in terms of processor memory, or potentially disk, then it's time to add a new item to the tier. Luckily with SharePoint, it's pretty straightforward to add a new item to any tier. It's just, you know, get a server, put the bits on it, connect it to the farm, and then configure the services you want to run there, and you're pretty much ready to go.
And there's no outage for that. It just comes online immediately.
Yeah. In fact, my understanding is the way Office 365 works is that it automatically detects if a tier is coming under too much load. And if it sees that, then it will automatically fire up a new VM and set it up and join it to the farm.
You know, Jeff, when you were talking about some of the problems difficulty you had doing all the installation steps for each of these tiers, you know, you mentioned all the configuration that had to be done. You know, Cale, I was thinking about the Azure automation. Couldn't Jeff create an Azure automation runbook or something to automate some of this?
I was gonna ask Jeff the same, if he had scripted any of this out, and or if he had any ways of leveraging maybe the resource groups or any of those features in Azure to do some of that stuff for him.
I have not looked at the automated things with the runbooks. Yeah, so I don't know if that would be helpful or not. I do know that traditionally, if you've wanted to script out SharePoint, it is a insane amount of PowerShell.
I think they do have scripts for just for SharePoint itself. They do have runbooks, but I'm talking about taking all those runbooks now and creating a more, because you've got a very specialized environment, right, for the self-service BI, which has all these various tiers and areas. So I'm just thinking, you know, I'm it just says. something to keep in the back of your mind. If you find this is something that is popular enough, that would be something that would be very valuable, I think, to the community.
I think automation of SharePoint has it's a weak spot in the product, in my opinion. Usually, if you go to a SharePoint conference and you say, well, what are the ways to automate the deployment, they tend to point you to stuff out on Codeplex, like the AutoSP installer, which kind of works, but it's not in my mind the cleanest solution. Like it's not all flashy and stuff. But I mean, it's literally like thousands of lines of PowerShell, and you configure a file and you run this thing and it'll go off and kind of do it. But I'm just not at a point where I feel like that's really, you know, the optimal solution.
Okay. Great.
And it's an area where our partners, you know, all of our partners seem to make products that do this. And they go off and try to sell it, but it's a hassle when you get into these big fonts.
Sure, sure. Well, I hope we do put together something so that, you know.
I keep hoping.
Say that again?
I said I keep hoping.
Yeah, I know.
When they looked for feedback on 2013 and they were looking at, you know, is this something we should be doing? I said, yes. Gave my feedback. But.
That's great. All right, that's a nice discussion with Jeff on doing self-service BI in Azure. Very, very nicely put, Jeff. Thank you very much for all those insights. Kayla, you have any last questions or thoughts for Jeff?
No, this has been awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff, for taking the time to walk us through that. That was pretty awesome.
Oh, good.
Well, Jeff, then thank you again. And Kayla, we'll see you and hopefully Evan next week.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.